All right, it's great to have you again on camera, Dave.
Great to be back, Charles.
Excellent. So who do we have today?
We got Michael Feathers.
Awesome.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for coming on C9.
Thanks.
Great. Well, I think most people out there know who Michael Feathers is. We're fortunate to have him here in Yao, and here in Sydney. And, first question we have to know is Michael Feathers. And when you write a really great book, you really get branded by it. So Michael wrote this great book, Working Effectively with Legacy Code.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's like being a movie star. You do that one film and you sort of wish it never happened again. But I understand you still find legacy a challenging area.
Oh, yeah.
It's so important.
Right? It is. Yeah, it definitely is important. I think the thing that's been kind of interesting for me, well, I don't know. The technical challenges are interesting. But the thing that I really like about it is essentially it's a way of going in concretely, helping people do better at their work, you know, or making their work a bit more joyful in a sense. Software can be a real slog sometimes. And, if you're able to go and do various things to go and make your work easier, then why not? And it's a pervasive problem, and it's something which still, people are still dealing with day in and day out. So, yeah, I'm spending a lot of time, working with teams, helping them, get better at developing software and also make headway in the code bases that they currently have.
So that's a very important area. In fact, you're doing your current workshop is called Brutal Refactoring.
Yeah. It's kind of a little bit of a markety, term in essence. But I was trying to sort of figure out exactly how to best describe the stuff I've been doing recently. The book that I wrote is really focused an awful lot on getting tests around existing code in order to go and make it easy to refactor. And it's been about 5 years since I wrote that, a little bit over 5 years actually now. And a lot of the work that I've done since then is basically, well, once you get tests in place, how can you actually start making larger scale refactorings stick within a code base and help the team develop code in a better way? And so the workshop is, it's really all about things I've learned since then, and a lot of team dynamics things, a lot of information about detecting bad areas in code and determining what the ROI is for basically making various changes in the code base. Mm-hmm.
And is this likely to appear in a sequel to?
Very possible. Yeah. It's funny. There's a couple of different book ideas I'm working on right now, so I'm kind of going back and forth between them and stuff like that. But I have a lot of material related to that, and so it's a matter of just getting it down.
Good. Yeah. I know it's much more fun to do things than it is to write them down.
Yeah, there's that. There's that.
If you really like software, writing the book is like, oh yeah, I really need to get back to that.
Yeah. It really helps with the spread of ideas.
I would look forward to that. Yes. Here you're talking about something that, a new phrase, at least new to most people, software mechanics. What's software mechanics?
The name, I kind of arrived at that as just a way of kind of describing like a body of knowledge about software design that I really wish I had awareness of about 20 years ago. I think that's an interesting thing these days is that if you get into software development, either you go to university and take a lot of stock courses, or you learn from friends, you learn from things on the internet and stuff like that. And it's really a haphazard process. And so I think some of the most important things I've learned about software design have been things that took me years and years to kind of discover and figure out. So giving a talk on that, and just a lot of snippets, about 17 of them, and it's been a fun thing to go and describe that, there's possibly a book in that also.
Are you committing to both of these now?
Well, I'm not committing to both. Of them. I'm committing to one of those.
Okay, yeah. So he's going to ship one out of two.
Yeah, one out of two. Right, that's okay. Hedge the bet, I guess, in a way.
Now, one of the other things you've been doing is looking at large code bases. I know particularly, your work at Groupon. And, mm-hmm. But, outside of that, since you left Groupon and prior to that, you've been, coming up with kind of metrics or ways of viewing things. Turbulence, I think, was one of them. Yeah. Can you talk a bit about what
sure.
this is, understanding?
Sure. It's kind of like a realization that, in essence, people have been throwing around, or digging into the big data, thing for a while now, going in mining data and enterprises and stuff along those lines. Things kind of occurred to me is that people hardly ever do that with code bases. They hardly ever, do that sort of thing with their source code repository. And we have an incredible amount of information within them. I've been basically writing scripts and stuff like that to go and find things out about how a development team works, how individual developers work, finding hot spots in code, things along those lines. The thing you mentioned, Turbulence, is really a, it was a small little application that I pieced together over a couple of days with Chad Fowler and Corey Haynes. And the idea was to go and basically sort of graph a number of commits for any particular piece of software in your code base versus its complexity. And it turns out they can find out an awful lot about a project by looking at graphs like that and give you some sense of where you want to go and move beyond that. The thing that's a little bit different with this is that quite often people are spending time doing static analysis, you know, and sort of like looking at what their code is today. But how you get there is at least as important. You know, it can help you learn early signs of dysfunction and get yourself back on the straight and narrow.
Sure, because you can. I'm sure you can find things like classes and methods that have been that are sort of churning, right? That you know,
yeah,
you know, just sort of history is if you, that some classes and her modules are just sort of sick, right? And
yeah.
You notice that they people keep going back to them until eventually you know, need to say basically, look, we can't take you back for surgery anymore.
Yeah,
you know, we really do have to remove your heart and
exactly.
put a new
or
one
put
in.
Put it behind the shed, shoot it, get a new put a new class in its place.
And this would give some evidence for that. You know,
yeah,
and, so I think that's one of the things that's always hard. Software managers, I don't know what your experience is mm-hmm. to tell them, look, you know. Sometimes rewriting is actually better trying to fix. And
definitely
the challenge is you can't rewrite everything. So, you know,
what
are those things where we really want to make the investment, right? So
Yeah. And it does feel like this is kind of like, there is some knowledge around this that isn't really popularized yet. I think that, you know, organizations need to pay an awful lot more attention to this, to be able to make, you know, very informed decisions about whether to rewrite or refactor and stuff along those lines. That's just... You know, it seems that's something that we can do today, but a
and
lot of people
I know that we found we were able to do these sort of, I would call it software analytics over your code base,
mm-hmm.
and we found that you know we could really look at the patterns of usage. And when you have a global development team, and you can look at your repository, and you can see the different patterns of usage, then this really and tells you a lot about your development teams in
yep.
the sense you can essentially do your review, you know, with your you can have your sort of corporate software dashboard, so you can see, you know, where, maybe where the code smells are building up,
yeah.
From a distance, right, by just seeing the churn in the code base.
Yeah, there's a lot to learn. It's like information is power. I think the other thing aspect to it also is learning when you see things, learning not to overreact to them. Also, you know, and I've seen people use metrics in particularly cruel and misformed ways, you know, and but yeah, I, with a bit of temperance, you can basically guide development based upon what you see.
Yeah, I think that's been one of the challenges. Is that you know, seems like the measurements only bought in for the developers, right? And so, and they you know they tend to be you know when the light goes amber, the intermediate management often rushes to cover it over as opposed to using it as a positive signal. So
yeah,
I think the biggest. I think it's important to work, you know, some companies we work together in, to actually, you know, explain to the senior management, you know, how to use this metric data and how to use it to say, look, you know, there's probably a problem with load. I mean, one of the things we've tracked, I don't mm-hmm. know whether you've looked mm-hmm. at in your days, is when did the actual feature request come in to the backlog
mm-hmm.
and found some horrible things that there's this code that released it, all sorts of bugs that people were very upset. When it actually was put in by a senior executive, the actual feature request just before code freeze.
Yeah.
So in fact, you actually see requirements churn, and so it's important to track those
yeah,
other
the
things that are part of the process, right? And similarly, you know, I don't know whether you do. We've tracked estimates.
Mm-hmm.
What you find out some people are really good at doing estimates. Some people are really bad.
Yeah.
And so often you find, like, if you look at the data, you'll see schedule slips and problems that some people, well, these people need to go out and have some coaching on estimation or something like that, or, you know,
yeah.
maybe need to get Don in and talk to them a bit about how to do their planning and get their batch sizes and things right. So you can, I think that, but the challenge is to get managers to use this data to plan over the longer term to figure out what kind of training, how can I complement the team, what
yeah.
are the loads and requests look like. And,
yeah, because it's funny because once in a while when they talk about this, people say, oh, that sounds like a very technical discipline. It's kind of like, you know, doing analysis over a code base to go and discover all these things. But, you know, the real power in this is what you do use the information for and how you make organizational decisions and stuff like that.
I know one of the surprising things that hasn't been published for good reason is that analysis that in some large defense longitudinal sort of 20-year analysis and and work done, for instance, at companies like, a telecommunication company, I probably shouldn't say. Okay. They showed over 20 years that the defects and the on-time delivery were the two things they're most concerned of. You know, did we, who got things, how did things get done on time? Mm-hmm. And, where were the low or high defects? And they found over time that this is like across different operating systems, different processes, different programming languages over a 20-year period that it correlated with individuals and teams.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is not something you really want to publish, unfortunately. But I think knowing this allows an organization to say, look, there seems to be, these people seem to perform very well. Maybe we can pair those with these other people so they can share their experience and come better, right? So it's not about, an Orwellian society. It's enabling people to use this to sort of help the organization. But I think we need to, software managers, I think, really need this. And I mean, on what your experience is, right?
Yeah, no, they do. And I think that's the thing is that, we're really poised now in the industry because analytics has become such a big thing in other areas that software is being developed for, to basically sort of like, turn the mirror back on ourselves, in essence. And, there's a lot to be done.
One of the areas in legacy, because legacy is such a big problem in the industry. I mean, legacy is, it's really the wrong word. It's really, this is that's why I call it legacy gold, because most people are making their money from their legacy code, right? So, yes. And I think there's been a lot of talk about, we can just, solve this problem. But in practice, I think often you have to really innovate and find clever ways to do this, because there really aren't the tools to really, are you aware of any tools that really let you, support you in the refactoring a very large code base?
There's a lot of micro refactoring tools, but as far as, macro, no, there's usually too many human decisions that need to be made with that sort of thing. And it takes a good deal of time. I think the biggest thing that people really need help with these days is making the ROI decision about whether to rewrite or refactor in particular cases. And to investigate the architecture well enough to understand what's feasible within a code base, going forward, and when you need to go and actually just branch off and do something different. Those are big questions that a lot of people
have. There's some very interesting tools, and I don't want to omit one, but, basically produce like DSMs, which should be used in the beginning of a design, not the end. But if you actually knew what your dependencies were, maybe you could plan your project better and your testing and so on. But I think a lot of people in software, that's one of the things that software mechanics, maybe very few people even know what a DSM is, right?
Yeah.
Which comes from manufacturing.
Yeah, dependency structure matrices, look it up. It's very important stuff. Yeah. Okay.
But these tools sort of give you these after-the-fact pictures, visually or in the in the DSM. Often you sort of go, hey, we've got the picture.
What do we do?
What do we do? Mm-hmm. And sometimes they can highlight them. Now a couple of them you can actually simulate, right? The coupling, and so you can actually snip them,
and
they'll show how much the code's going to come apart and things like that. But I think it's, in your experience, it's still really a challenge about, okay, what are we really going to do, and how do we trade off this refactoring against this new feature?
Yeah, there is. I mean, the thing is, the tools like DSMs and stuff like that are there, they're useful, but the thing that which seems to be missing in many cases is the institutional knowledge about, when are we, what is feasible to target as far as like a big refactoring in a code base? That's the thing that a lot of people aren't, from what I've seen,
Now you're always moving with the technology, expert in C++.
Don't say that out loud. I've been trying to bury that one, right?
It's a
great language, but
it's all right. I know COBOL, so that's in Fortran. So
you heard it here.
I can't get rid of that. Yeah, you heard.
Yeah.
But you've been doing a lot with some large Ruby things. I mean, are things really that different between languages, or do you find that once you get to a legacy code base, kind of whether it's in the latest new flashy thing or the old code base, what you have any sense about?
It seems like more power can basically lead to more trouble in a way sometimes. I mean, as far as languages are concerned, it's like with Ruby, you can get into this metaprogramming morass where people become metaprogramming happy and just do all sorts of crazy things. The thing that was most surprising to me, because it's only in the past couple of years I've really like dug in deep with a very large dynamically typed programming language project, was I expected a lot of things to be easier when it came to testing and stuff along those lines, and I expected certain things to be a bit different. The one thing that really struck me was to discover that, at least in Ruby and Rails and stuff like that, the thing that hurts the most is tying yourself down to a framework, right? And it seems like that historically has been a problem with statically typed languages too. And you know, if you have a framework, if you basically just sort of like not build any, if you don't build a barrier between you and the framework, quite often testing is difficult, reusing code in different areas is difficult, even in just understanding things. And over again, working in Rails projects, I've seen this kind of thing that, you know, it's like when you just couple yourselves too tightly to the framework, you're in trouble. And I didn't expect that. I kind of expected with dynamic typing that things would be a bit easier and the recovery end of that sort of thing. But it has its own challenges. It really does.
One of my more infamous remarks is that frameworks inject dependencies into your code. And
that's fair.
Maybe you comment on this. My perception is that the framework is kind of a component that got escaped too early, right? So the framework is, you know, basically the component isn't done, yeah. Right? So since it's not quite done, what we're going to give you is we're going to give you the kit, yep. Right? So you can sort of put it together yourself. But the problem is that means that you have to have intimate knowledge of what's going on. You end up reaching inside, and you end up getting these tight coupling and dependency with the framework, which of course in makes testing and everything else.
That tends to be the case. I mean, you can look at generally a framework as an incomplete application, right? So, and it's basically just the promise is you can just go and add in the little things that you want to go and make your application. But you're building directly on something, and if you don't have some kind of a wedge between you and it, you can just run into trouble. That just seems to be the case.
Yeah, and I think in some cases that's kind of, you know, I think in some cases if you have a real component model where you can only exchange values and not objects between components, or that kind of microservices that Fred George is talking about here, you have this loose coupling between things because you're only exchanging values, so it lets you pull them apart and put them on different machines.
What's so striking to me with that is that it's kind of funny that people do end up with like very nice decoupled architectures for a variety of reasons, but it's hardly ever the case that it was planned in a particular way. Like this one team I worked with in Boston, you had people working on one side, they were doing a UI in Swing, Java Swing, this is a while back, and then the other side was doing all the business logic and stuff like that. The fact that they had two separate teams working on this meant that they had actually a decent API between these two things. If they didn't have separate teams, you know, doing this, it just would have been just a big snarl, like quite often, it quite often happens in many mixed integrated environments.
Are you saying that you should actually like have separate teams that don't own the whole code base?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. So I don't know how many of the listeners here are familiar with Conway's Law, but it's like, you know, Melvin Conway back in the 1970s made this observation that whenever you design a system, it's pretty much doomed to mirror the structure of the organization that produces it, right? And it's really a very powerful, you know, subtle thing that seems to be just pervasive in the entire world of design. But I think it's kind of interesting because we've gone back and forth with this in the industry. Right. It's like component teams and then getting to the point of like, oh, having everybody in a big group and then anybody can work on anything and stuff like that. What I think is powerful is at least to understand that social structure impacts, you know, your technical structure. And if you understand that at the management level, then you can actually make very realistic choices like, oh, we want an API here. Let's separate the teams for 3 months, right? Yeah. Oh, now we can merge things together because we have a decent API here. And just tending the code base and understanding what personnel decisions you have to make in order to go and achieve certain design outcomes. That's like a very integrated approach to design that I wish I saw more people, you know.
Right, and certainly that's why, you know, we emphasize for lean and agile and large projects, basically, you want your organization, you know, sort of the great quote from Fred Brooks is you ship your organization. Mm-hmm. And so that you want to basically align your product architect, align your teams along how your architecture works and their interfaces.
Yeah.
And you can generally tell looking at if you look at a product and you know anything about what's going on inside the organization, the organizational structure, both good and bad, is reflected in the actual actual product.
Yeah, and it's just kind of odd. It seems like many organizations just aren't really aware of that. And you know, there are some, you know, organizations where basically they see themselves as technical, pretty high up the stack in the organization, and others where it's kind of like, well, you know, we're a bank, for instance, and we need software. So those people in that other room, they make software for us. And it's like as soon as it feels like it's kind of off the main arc of the organization, you know, it doesn't feel quite as integrated, and you don't get to take advantage of that, you know, unless you're really thinking about it. You know?
Well, it's interesting. One of the big emphasis, I mean, it's hard to believe that here, you know, in 2012, you know, we still have, you know, speakers getting up and saying, remember, it's very important to specify the interface and not the implementation. I mean, that message is still coming out in this conference, right? Which is sort of, but I think one of the challenges is that, you know, I don't know what you found, in many organizations, there's a, you know, the product product cultures and project cultures are very different.
Yep.
And in IT, large IT shops, they have a lot of projects. Mm-hmm. And so in many cases, they've not been, you know, I mean, these people have come up from other backgrounds and, mm-hmm. you know, are building the applications, but they're not aware of the fact that, you know, these concepts of interfaces and so on, that, you know, if you've come up through, you know, engineering or science, you know, interface is kind of a natural concept. Separation of concerns is like, of course.
Yeah.
But in practice, you know, we've given technologies which require you to use these interfaces to people who really are not familiar with the ideas or concepts.
Yeah.
You know? I'm not sure who's, you know, you can say, well, look, you know, you people in this project culture need to understand how to separate concerns and interfaces, or maybe we shouldn't be giving those kind of tools to people that are busy trying to build applications. And, you know,
And it's funny because it seems like everything is, you know, it's changing all the time. And I think the thing that, you know, you and I have just been talking about with project culture and stuff, I mean, people are making headway in that. They are, you know, moving towards better design and stuff like that. It takes time, you know. I don't know, it's kind of a, you kind of hope that with this sort of thing that people don't sort of like just, you know, that new organizations don't pop up that basically just sort of like use a 20-year-old model. It happens occasionally, though. It's a shame, you know, but.
Do you have any tricks to talking to, you know, managers about, you know, how to do the refactoring and things like that? You know, often the developers will claim that, you know, they would do this if only, you know, their manager wouldn't do it. It's, you know, of course, we know it goes both ways. Yeah. Often the manager wishes these people, they're supposed to be refactoring as they go.
Yeah.
It seems like the sort of, I mean, agile excuse is, oh, you know, we're really, you know, emergent design, emergent this, and then all of a sudden they're complaining we're the technical debt cards, and it seems to me like, you know, just before they were making the technical debt and not telling us, and now.
Yeah, there's that. And I think the thing that I really, you know, am leaning more towards these days is visualizations of what you've got, right? And making sure that even the non-technical people in your organization know a bit about what's there, right? Because then it isn't quite a surprise, you know, I mean, metaphorically, imagine having like a garden, right? And it's like everybody can look at the garden at any time. They can see what's going on. They can see weeds growing. They can see the flowers blooming and all this other stuff. And then it's not really a surprise. You know, if you're a non-technical person, you can see some image of what's going on with things. And then you kind of know, you know, how safe are you? How far in the weeds are you? You know, that kind of thing. And then you're playing around with visualizations with regard to that. I think the thing that really strikes me now is I feel that in Agile, we've kind of done a disservice in a way by going and saying, hey, that we can drive all of development through features, you know, and cards and stuff like this. That's, you know, as I don't know how many people, like Joel Spolsky's Law of Leaky Abstractions. You know, basically I feel that Agile in a way is a leaky abstraction. We tend to, you know, make people believe that essentially you can drive through this particular interface of features, but of course you end up with all these crazy side effects. And, you know, I mean, there are Agile teams that do extremely well, but quite often, the thing that you aren't looking at is the thing which ends up hurting you, and often that's just massive accumulated technical debt. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, actually, Eric Dornenberg
was
gave a nice talk on that earlier at Yale. So.
He loves doing visualizations for these kinds of things. I think the thing that's nice for a team is to settle on something which is familiar, and you can essentially just sort of like just, you know, this is what we look at, and that tells us where things stand.
Yeah, the lean principle of put it on the wall, make it visible, you know, transparency is really important. And in the organizations where you can see these sort of wall charts, right, you know, where they actually have a picture of the, you know, in some cases they have a picture of the architecture or some, I don't know.
The supposed architecture.
Some places you go to and you ask them for the architecture and they show you J2EE or...
Yeah, exactly.
I meant the application. Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
didn't we do one of those back... There's some UML somewhere, right?
Yeah.
But I think the ones that actually have these sort of living pictures that produce... You know,
No, it's weird because that's the thing that people just don't really look at. And they really should. It's you know, I think that's the tragedy really of like project culture in essence. It's like from a certain point of view in the organization, it looks like a list of features. At the end, you get that list of features. And the thing that everybody forgets is that there's this big swath of code that persists from project to project to project all the way across the organization. And when you have that thing and you're not tending its health, you know, that's, you know, it's a travesty. And it often ends up, you know, and you often end up in situations where change is extremely difficult because nobody's been tending the garden in a way, you know?
Yeah, well, I think this is something that, of course, you know, Voda and I have had some active debates because they're very much into all you need is features, mm-hmm. which I think is true in many cases if you're bug fixing. Mm-hmm. Your backlog is only features, but you know, in Agile and large, we balance off feature teams with component teams.
Yeah.
So because if you only do is features, then there's no commitment to stable components or architectures. Mm-hmm. You get stuff out, which is what happens in a project culture. You say, look at all the projects you've got, but then you pay all this cost later because you've got all this accumulated extra code and interface problems and so on.
Yeah.
So the challenge is balancing, you know, we definitely want to have features mm-hmm. and we don't want, you know, sort of monolithic, you know, a lot of people confuse component with subsystem in my experience, right? Your organizational piece, but you know, you want to have smaller components which are well designed. To do that, they have to have a component backlog. Mm-hmm. They can't be trying to do everything.
Yeah, and what's terrible is everybody's always looking for the right thing. It's like, oh, it should only be feature teams. It should just be component teams. Yeah. To me, what's key is basically getting an organization to recognize at certain times and in certain contexts you want this, and you should be able to change back and forth between these things in a very dynamic way in order to solve real problems that you have. Yeah. And it's tough because it really goes and enters into the whole people dimension and, you know, the organizational dimension. But you know, there's great advantages to, you know, be gained for doing that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things I've said, looking at lean, of course, comes from manufacturing mm-hmm. and then applied to design. And you know, Don was been in doing an interview, giving a great keynote. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one of the simple things there is you don't find different manufacturing companies basically using the same process, right? They actually mm-hmm. take some principles, think about it, and analyze, and their process always changes. And I think one of the process traps in software is that we have the process, right? And it's going to be very different if you're doing embedded systems or mission critical stuff to if you're doing a website. Right? You know, the whole notion that there's 7 commandments or 250 rules or whatever it is with associated. I mean, it seems like even the simple processes have some of the same flaws as the larger ones, that they're not adapted. They're just sort of accepted as religion. You
know? Yeah, and that's the thing. People just miss that adaptation step all the time, unfortunately. It's very important.
Yeah, very interesting to hear Fred's talk and programmer anarchy. That's going to make mm-hmm. a few people think, because really, you know, snip, 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 all these things are gone, right?
Yeah, and it's because he has a particularly, you know, very nice, well-designed context for that sort of thing.
Exactly.
But it's very eye-opening to recognize.
It fits very well in the sort of in the financial community where they're able to monitor and control and, mm-hmm. and things like that, but a challenge for others.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very
much,
Michael.
Thank you very much. It's been fun.
Great to have you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Charles.
Thank you.
Thank you.